Anne Marie, you began your writing career with plays, the most well-known being Goodnight, Desdemona, Good Morning, Juliet. Mm-hmm. And since then, you've written two best-selling novels, Fall on Your Knees and The Way the Crow Flies. I'm curious as to why you switched formats.
I didn't switch. I didn't choose to start writing a novel. It really chose me. When I started writing Fall on Your Knees, I thought I was writing another play. Mm-hmm. And I got stuck because the stage directions just kept getting longer and longer and longer. And I thought, this is a really bad play. And then, I don't know if you're familiar with the story of the ugly duckling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an ugly duckling, I'm a beautiful swan. I realized that maybe it's not a bad play. It might be, I don't know if it'll be a good novel or not, but it might be a novel mm-hmm. instead. So the story arrived, and I was really stuck at first because I was determined to make it into a play. And I consulted a friend of mine who I'd worked with a great deal in theater. And she said, well, when are you going to start your novel?
Interesting.
And I said, what novel? She said, well, you are eventually going to write novels. And I said, I am. And she said, yes, it's obvious. And I said, well, I have to confess it's crossed my mind, but I thought that's something you do when you're much, much older. And she said, you might be much older by the time you finish it, so why don't you start now? And then that something in my head clicked, and I thought, I think I've started. I think that's what these pages and pages of stage directions are. They're not stage directions, they're prose. Mm-hmm. And that was a moment equal parts elation and horror. Elation because I was released, the logjam was broken, mm-hmm. because I recognized what form this story wanted to, what kind of body this story wanted to be born into. Horror because I had never written a novel. It was entirely new to me, so I had to learn as I went along.
Now, both the formats deal with very different audiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you are writing for stage, and also when you're on stage, because you are a professional actor, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So the audience there is very different versus the audience that you see when you're writing a novel. So what were your challenges there?
When you're on stage, when I'm on stage as an actor, or when I've written a play and I'm sitting in the audience, among the audience watching the show, I know when they noisily open a lozenge. I know when someone leaves, if someone leaves. I know when people laugh. I know when they hold their breath. As a novelist, I don't know. They can close my book at any moment because of an interruption, because their mind has wandered, because they can't stand it anymore, because they want to save it for later. But I'm not there. I can't see that moment. But that said, audiences are audiences. Readers are just like audiences in a theater. They're people who are benevolently inclined. They're open. They are yearning to be taken on a journey. They're willing. And they've paid money.
Mm-hmm.
There's the...
Do you
want me to ask the question again?
I think the first part of the answer was usable.
Yes,
okay.
It was. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah. So I'll just continue.
You were talking about mm-hmm. the candy yeah. wrappers.
Yeah. I think we were okay on that.
We were.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to pick up a little bit later. Hang on. I'll get there in a second. I'm ready.
Okay.
To my mind, an audience is an audience, whether they're sitting in a theater or whether they're sitting in an armchair or bed or on a train or on the subway. And it's funny because I don't know if it's to do with my background in theater or not, but I realize that I not only write with the reader in mind, I ask myself, well, who is that reader? And I realized that I actually had a visual image. I have this kind of ghostly form, a face. I can't make out the features. It hovers just about here. It's this kind of ghostly, yearning, benevolently inclined listener saying, take me on this journey and be my guide. So I have that. I get a chill when I think about it. I like to think I'm not superstitious, but... I don't believe in ghosts, but I don't think that matters to the ghosts, mm-hmm. whether or not I believe in them. But that said, I take my job as a writer, as a guide, very seriously. It's, you know, Virgil invites Dante into the underworld, into the inferno, and says, it's going to be frightening, but stick with me. We're going to make it all the way through, and we'll make it back out to the light. And you have to trust the author, especially when you're inviting people to journey through some dark places. Mm-hmm. Even though they're, you know, I'm essentially a comedian. Everything's always going to be leavened with humor. And there are a number of reasons for that. But I am going to invite the audience to come on a journey that is not necessarily going to be easy. I might ask you to come someplace that you'd never dream of going voluntarily, much less paying money for. It's my job to make it feel inevitable and to build and earn your trust as a reader.
How much control do you feel that you have in either situation? For example, on stage you hear the candy wrapper. Or in any way, do you feel that you have the control of maybe if, you know, how do I get their attention? For like a novelist can stand up and read, let's say, the first 5 pages that he or she has written and get a sense for that ghost being there and reading and saying, oh, I know I've lost in there. I know I've lost. So I'm going to control this and pull it back in. Do you have any sense of more control over your ghost than the audience in the theater?
Well, there are a number of things involved. I don't know. I don't think that I have more control over the reader's experience than I have over the live audience's experience. I think the degree of I don't even think of it as control, but of, I guess I'm orchestrating their experience. Mm-hmm. I'm their guide, right? I'm mm-hmm. going to lead them through this thing. I try very hard to see through the eyes of the reader or to see through the eyes of the person who's sitting in the theater seat. I try to pull back and forget everything I know and see it purely through their eyes. And that's an exhausting task. That's the ultimate acting role, is to imagine you're seeing all these things afresh. So there's that, and there are also just the very technical requirements of pace and structure, mm-hmm. of knowing by instinct and experience as a writer, at what point does the reader need relief or a break? At what point can I completely turn left or change gears radically? And they'll feel as though cold water is splashed on them. For example, maybe someone dies suddenly, and they go, what? Why should I continue on, you know? But what are the inducements to get them to turn that page? Well, old-fashioned narrative. It's more apparent in genre fiction. If it's a mystery, if it's a thriller, it's an action novel, it's sci-fi. Genre writing, and it can be brilliant or it can be far from brilliant, but what you've got are stripped-down narrative structures that really work, and it's all about pace and momentum and getting people to turn the pages. Well, so-called literary fiction can benefit from that as well, because these mm-hmm. are old structures. Myth is built on traditional narrative structures. It's not just pulp fiction that uses these structures. It's deeply embedded in us as human beings gathered around a campfire, tell me a story. So I like to call on elements of mystery and suspense mm-hmm. and ghost story. And I kind of build my stories, the structure of them, follow those lines so that hopefully there is a pull, there's a narrative pull that gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And on that, I hang the texture of the characters. And I try to pick when it's going to be leisurely and expansive and when it's going to be breathless and how long I can afford to stay in either mode.
Speaking of the pacing, both of your novels are long. They're more than 500 pages, which actually is turning out to be quite the industry trend. There was an article in Publishers Weekly recently that
really?
Said that a lot of novelists are turning out the books that what we call in the industry, we call them doorstoppers. But did you get to a certain page, like page 400, 500, whatever, and think, I'm way beyond the 300 page, I may lose them? We're living in an era where people are not reading as much, so the NEA tells us. And did you worry about that at all?
I don't worry about length. You know who worries about length? In my experience, publishers worry about length because the book as object is more expensive to produce.
Okay.
That's a very pragmatic consideration. Often reviewers will worry about length because they're going, oh, I've got 3 days to read this book. Why does it have to be so long? You know who does not worry about length and who is actually length-friendly? The reader. Readers love a generous story.
Because it absorbs them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. If it's good, they go, let's get lost in this narrative. Yes. So I think maybe, and also, you know, every so often, I always remember when I was a kid, I think it was 1967 or something around there, Time magazine, God is dead. I'll never forget that. And that's how I feel about every time, every so often, someone comes out with the idea that the book is dead. People don't read. Well, maybe not as many people read as could. And I know that in the U.S., that's a problem. I mean, that's why Oprah invented her book club. Mm-hmm. Because per capita, the U.S. reads less than most other industrialized Western nations. So, yeah, campaigns for literacy and love of literature, I think that's all very important. But what I also know is that love of reading is never going to die. I have complete faith in that because as long as we are human and have societies, people are going to crave one another's stories.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that the book will ever die.
Also, when I was working on these books, it may sound funny, perhaps it's ironic, but I distill everything. I try to make everything as efficient as I possibly can. So when people say, well, you've written a rather long book, I go, hey, it could have been longer. You don't know what I cut.
Yes.
I cut slash and burn.
Oh, that's great. Now, Goodnight Desdemona is a comedy. Mm-hmm. It's very fun, very funny. And yet your two novels then deal with some very difficult topics. They're very profound. One of them being child abuse. Mm-hmm. And which you say is not part of your personal experience. So I'm wondering why you've chosen that subject matter. Or, as you had mentioned earlier, did it choose you?
I get asked that. And mm-hmm. I've done a lot of thinking about why have I been compelled to write about this subject again. First of all, it's an issue. It's a real-life issue that has been yanked screaming out of the closet somewhere around the past 20 years. The headlines are full of it. It's real. It's a crime that affects so many more people than the initial victim. It just ripples outward, and the effects are toxic socially. But it's more than that. It's more than a social issue. I think it is actually a core narrative. And by that I mean it is part of an older story. Why do we not tire of war stories or mm-hmm. stories of opening up a frontier? It's because this story is a story of a quest for identity after the self has been usurped in some way. I think that child abuse as a crime is a crime of theft or attempted theft of the self. Mm. And when you think of old epics like Gilgamesh, or fairy tales like Rapunzel, or Shakespeare's The Tempest, or Job in the Old Testament. These are stories of people who have been usurped. Their identity has been assaulted. I was the duke. I am nothing now. I have been banished. I was a man with 10,000 camels. Now I have 10,000 boils covering my body. It's about the quest to restore the self after a terrible assault, a terrible theft. When a child is sexually assaulted, abused, or seduced, because children do feel sexual pleasure, and that just compounds the horror of the crime, because they do feel guilty, because they feel as though they've been in collusion, they can spend, that individual can spend the rest of their lives, or a good portion of their lives, trying to find out who they would have been if this hadn't happened. Am I who I am because of a crime that was perpetrated against me? Or am I who I am in spite of a crime? And finally, if that quest bears any fruit, the result hopefully is, you know what, no one stole myself from me. No one can do that. I've got to reconnect with that self and listen to the story that it has to tell. And we're all products of history, and history isn't always pretty. But no one's going to go through life unmarked. It's about how you deal with what happens to you. Mm-hmm. I use the comparison with The Tempest because Prospero is a duke who is usurped and banished to an island. And when you think about people who have gone through a form of abuse, there's a retreat to an island of the self. There's a there are sometimes extreme behaviors which manifest as sexual promiscuity or the opposite, anorexia, bulimia. Think of Prospero as two familiar spirits. One is Caliban, the rapacious, earth-dwelling, you know, physical trog man. The other one is Ariel, who I think of as the anorexic, bodiless girl spirit. Not to reduce Shakespeare, because it means much more than that. He's got his magical books. He's got to feel that he's in control of the elements. And I think that when people are abused, they feel even more responsible. It's almost like it's better that the abuse should have been my fault than that bad stuff can just happen to you. Because I'll lose my mind if I think the world works that way. It's like children of divorce. It must be my fault. The alternative is I don't even matter. It doesn't matter what I do. So there's that guilt, you know.
Are you hoping that readers, beyond being enjoying your books, escaping into them, that they come away with newfound insight then about this topic?
Well, I think a lot of people have thought about this topic a lot. What I hope for is that what I strive to do is to reveal connections among seemingly disparate events. I want to make the connection between what happens at a rural intersection in 1962 in the middle of nowhere with that crime of child sexual abuse, and make the connection to what to the decisions that are being made in the Pentagon and down in NASA, to connect the very local with the global, because that is what happens in The Way the Crow Flies. A local murder intersects with global forces. This touches on a whole other vein, which is all about the narrative, the importation of a Nazi scientist to help with the space program in the U.S. and how that collides with a very local issue. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that the global and the local are very connected. I think, and that's part of my passion as a person brought up in a democratic country. I passionately believe that the personal is political, that the domestic, that what happens in your kitchen does matter, in the Pentagon or on Parliament Hill or wherever it is. It has to matter. It has to be connected. Otherwise, we're not living in a democracy. We're living in some kind of psychotic split.
Well, that then gets to individual responsibility.
Yeah.
Which then does connect to this thing also of child abuse, that the awareness on our part, then it's not a matter of just reading it in the newspaper and turning aside. But even if we don't feel there is something we can do, the first thing we can do is to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bear witness.
Mm-hmm. I read something in a Toronto publication about a year ago, or it was published in a Toronto publication about a year ago. You speak about a memory, and it sounds to me like it informs this in some way, but I can't make the connection. So I want to read the quote of what you said. You said, "I have a memory of moving to Ottawa when I was 12. I was watching the girls there playing. I stood at the foot of the driveway and said to myself, don't ever forget that it's terrifying. Don't ever look at a group of kids and say, how sweet. Why don't you join those kids, honey?" Mm-hmm. Something in that tells me that informs this issue about, if not about child abuse, something that goes on with children, that childhood is not always sweet and wonderful.
No.
And again, maybe it's something we need to bear witness to.
Mm-hmm. I think that childhood innocence is a concept that has become fetishized. And it implies, innocence is a noun, it's a static condition. Children are people too, they're in flux, they're changing all the time. If we insist on seeing them as citizens of a lost world, look at them just playing carefree, you know what, children are not carefree. Oh, they're new. And that newness is sometimes wonderful because everything is fresh and their imagination is unbounded and they're so available to be nurtured. But they're people. And when we insist on saying they're all sweet, they're all innocent, we imply immediately that eventually they're going to fall from innocence. And children are aware of that. It's almost like they know that, gee, if I'm not all sweetness and light, my parents aren't going to love me anymore. I can't tell them what's really going on at school because I'm supposed to be innocent. And kids pick up on this. Kids know that they're supposed to stay really pristine. Now, at what point do we cease to expect that of them? Well, when they're adolescents, then we demonize them. Mm-hmm. And so they go from this unjustified, kind of strange, whitewashed idea of innocence to, again, this broad strokes, the demon adolescent. And I think adolescents are really being demonized nowadays, certainly in the media and in Canada and here. And it reminds me of the 1950s when adults were terrified of these teenagers in dungarees and saddle shoes jitterbugging all over the place, you know. I think what we need simply to do is to listen to children and not make them feel like criminals unless they reflect back to us what they know we want to see, which is all sweetness and light. Kids are people, and they have their own little subcultures. And the idea that what has become fashionable recently as well is the idea that, well, you know, peers are more important to kids than parents are. And I go, that's absolute nonsense. Read Lord of the Flies.
Peers. Yes.
Friends are really important.
Yeah.
But kids are not supposed, we're not supposed to expect them to take responsibility for themselves and to run the world. They're raw. They're new. They need us. And they need us not to fetishize their youth.
Do you think some of that you came to or saw from all of the traveling that you did being a military child? Mm-hmm. I mean, you went in and out of different schools, cultures, whatever, as opposed to just staying in mm-hmm. one school. So you would have the benefit then almost of collecting data, whether knowingly yeah. or unknowingly.
Yeah. I think that's very true. Traveling around as we did, because my dad was in the Air Force, meant that from school to school, I gradually learned the lesson that although every individual is just that, an individual, broadly speaking, there are similar types to be found, and there are similar group dynamics, and there are similar personalities mm. at play. And people are going to come to the fore to cast themselves in those five roles that are going to be fulfilled in any peer group. Mm. And I always felt, I always really did feel as though I belonged and I didn't belong. I was on the inside and I was on the outside, always at the same time, never really at the heart of things. And because I didn't have those allegiances and I didn't depend on being part of a group, I mean, I could suffer because I wasn't really part of a group, but at the same time, I knew I was going to move away, or I had other resources, I had a strong family, I loved to read, so it wasn't really going to kill me, it would hurt me, but it wouldn't kill me to belong to that group. I was able to, my judgment wasn't clouded by an overwhelming need to belong, so I think I was able to see how cruel.
Yeah.
It really could be. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of plagued as well as a kid. I was the one that the real rejects. They knew that I would be nice to them and I wouldn't reject them. This was another thing. I suppose it's the curse of niceness, right? Because I think, I don't really want to be your friend, but I think I should, because no one else will be. Yeah. And so I was often caught in the middle. Mm-hmm. But what that meant was that I would have friendships with very different people. So that was an enriching experience, ultimately.
It sounds like it, and it sounds like, as I said, that you probably have seen a lot more than any other kid would growing up, because they're just in, you know, they stay, like, with their own group mm-hmm. through...
On the other hand, staying with your little microcosm can also be a recipe for an ability to keenly observe one's fellow... well, anyway, I'm getting mixed up here. But all I'm going to say is you can also look at very closed environments like the one that yes. the Brontes grew up in.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And from their little... mm-hmm. you know, circumscribed little speck on Earth in Yorkshire overlooking that cemetery where they only had each other, they managed to create an extraordinarily rich life that was mm-hmm. all about the inner life. So I think, in a way, I think extremes... both lend themselves
yeah.
to that ability to observe.
I can see that house and cemetery. Where, and I forget the name of the town.
It's in Yorkshire. Not Haworth. Haworth. Is it Haworth?
I think it's Haworth. Mm-hmm. And the pub that the Bronte that, brother went to.
Yeah, that he drank himself
yeah.
silly in. Yeah.
You're right. It was very much of a microcosm there. I'm curious about the research that you do. Mm. Simply because you take on some ambitious narrative scopes. I mean, you're dealing with Cold War espionage, space, race, politics. You have settings in Harlem in the 1920s. You work with World War I. How much research do you do, and at what point do you get where you know that you're comfortable enough to be able to write about it so you don't make the mistake of saying, making a reference to Saran Wrap before Saran Wrap was invented?
I do a huge amount of research, and I love the research aspect of things. I read, I travel, I track people down who were there then, who were there when. For example, with this book, I had to research what is still a relatively little-known concentration camp, underground factory called Dora, which is where the V-2 rockets were built by slaves, the V-2 rockets that then became the Saturn rockets and took us to the moon. I found two survivors who were able to tell me about it firsthand. It was incredible. But the research is obviously really important, and what I try to do, however, because research can also be seductive.
Yes, it can.
Is to allow the narrative and the characters to pose the questions that direct the course of my research. So I'll take my cue from the story itself, and that's kind of chicken and egg because, you know, what starts what? What if I refer to wagon wheel cookies in 1963 when, in fact, they didn't come along till 1969 or whatever? Well, the fact is that I go back. I go back with tweezers and a toothbrush like an archaeologist, and I have to redo things.
So will you write through at that point, though, or will you stop and say, I don't know if they had them, well, I'll just keep writing, highlight it, and come back?
It's a question of how... It's a question of the stakes that are involved. If I'm writing about a concentration camp and it's integral to the narrative, I kind of figure, you know what, I better have a pretty good idea of what I'm talking about before I just go headlong into this. Whereas if it's just something about a popular song or an object, I'll go, oh, this can screw me up later, but I'm just going to barrel through and I'll just put an asterisk there and know that that's work I'm going to do later. But I really do work very, very, very hard to get it right. And not just to get it right, but to get the other side. I'm interested in events when they're percolating, not when they're full-blown. So the research is sometimes more difficult. For example, The Parted Fall on Your Knees, which is set in Harlem, it's 1918-19. That's before Harlem was what we now know as Harlem. What we think of as Harlem is Cotton Club 1930s. Well, in 1919, Harlem was just beginning to be Harlem, and that's the most exciting part. But that's the part that's not documented, because those people weren't stars. They, you know, it was just kind of a chaotic, exciting time. It's not readily available to the researcher, but I find it more exciting because it's more raw. Same thing with the Cold War, to dig underneath it, and the space program. There's all the received propaganda about where it originated, but the fact is that when we don't look at the horror in which the space program originated, we dishonor the people who actually got us to the moon by cutting off an aspect of the story. I think it's a desecration of history not to include the origins in the story of spaceflight.
Have you had to stop and then take a long period of time and then go back to the writing and then do the voices? Do you have to coax them back?
I do take breaks from writing novels. I work on other things in tandem, which I find just at an unconscious level very refreshing. It's like crop rotation. Just let the nitrates.
Well, I was meaning also in terms of the research. Like, I have to stop and go do research, which is going to take me, and you find out you thought it was going to take you a couple days. It takes you 2 or 3 weeks, and then you have to come back. And as I said, do the voices of telling that story, are they just as alive as when you come back? Or
I find I can never take it for granted that the voices are going to be alive from one day to the next. And sometimes what the research does is it's almost like you've gone grocery shopping for the characters and you go, now eat. I've brought something to feed you with. And it can really, it is like it's like filling up the tank. And that's what I find with the research. For example, I did so much research into the United States Air Force at the time. One of the only real details that I used after all that research and speaking to a very helpful man, the archivist at Wright-Patterson Air Base in just near Dayton, I tracked down this wonderful man and he sent me all kinds of material, and it was just one stray comment he made about the color of the United States Air Force uniform in 1962, that it was blue, but it was the kind of blue that in certain lights imparted a gray sheen. And then I realized that was the one thing that I used. And it was a beautiful detail because it was the thing that made it different from a Canadian or a British Air Force uniform. Mm-hmm. And in my work, I deal a lot with twinning, the idea of, well, we're just the same except for shades of gray. At what point are we really different? And it's like the Cold War. At what point are we really in danger? At what point is it too late to do the right thing? At what point does what we're telling the public actually become a lie? Mm-hmm. At what point do our efforts to defend democracy turn into anti-democratic actions? Mm-hmm. At what point do we begin to undermine democracy in the guise of defending it and promoting it?
It's astounding that it sounds very satisfying. I mean, that was the first thing I thought of. For you personally to be able to have these issues and go down these paths and talk to these experts, for example, or to ask these questions and to work it out in a novel where someone driving along the road and thinking about this or hearing it, you know, doesn't have that outlet. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, well, it's the writer's job, right? Spend that time.
Yeah, it is.
To distill it.
I'd like to talk about your Oprah experience.
Okay.
She made you into a literary star with
in the U.S.
In the U.S.
Yeah.
In the U.S. she did.
Yeah.
With Fall on Your Knees. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm curious about it is because your experience with Oprah was about probably 3 or 4 years before Jonathan Franzen.
No, it was one after.
It was one after.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was.
I was just after him.
Okay, yeah. So I'm making the mistake then because I'm thinking the book coming out in 96
no,
or
no,
so.
No, this happened quite late in the game. My book was out all over the world in 17 countries. But
she chose it late in the game.
She chose it late in the game.
Ah, interesting.
There was Rohinton Mystery, Jonathan Franzen, me, Toni Morrison, and mm-hmm. then that was it, over. I was the second last pick on her book club.
So Jonathan Franzen wrote an interesting essay about his experience. It was called Meet Me in St. Louis.
And yeah, that's right. I read that.
Yes, and he's and I'm curious is if your experience was similar. For example, were you taken to your hometown and going through situations of, you know, he likened it to being put through a dog and pony show. Hmm. He felt it was artificial. He struggled. He broke out in a rash.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, he said something, which really in the essay, when you read, it just was not intentional, but it came out as intentional, which got him booted off the show.
I think he also declined to appear on the show and then changed his mind.
Okay.
Yeah.
But he was very uncomfortable mm-hmm. with having to go along with the requirements of the show.
To go along with the requirements, I don't see how it's any different from doing a book tour only 1,000 light years better.
Mm-hmm.
There are no requirements that were exotic. No, my experience was not like his at all. And quite frankly, I smelled sexism in his response to the whole thing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, Oprah's book club appeals to the broad band of a really busy, bright, from lower to middle to upper middle class women. Now, who buys books, reads books, goes to the theater, thinks? Who is the cultural engine? I remember when my first book was being published, my Canadian publisher took me into her office and said, I want to show you something. She showed me a pie graph. She said, here's who buys books, okay? About, you know, a ridiculously huge proportion, maybe like 6/8 women mm-hmm. between the ages mm-hmm. of X and X.
Yeah.
That's who buys books. They buy books for themselves, their friends, their husbands, their boyfriends, their sons, their family.
Mm-hmm.
This is who reads. And you know what? It has been ever thus. And women have also been mocked for getting together and forming learned societies, you know, at the turn of the century. Who was bringing in Charles Dickens and Freud? Who organized the lecture circuits? Women.
Mm-hmm.
Women with money and time. So for me, I just think that was very exciting to have access to such a huge audience of readers. I've had that question before, the Jonathan Franzen question, and am I comfortable with reaching millions and millions mm-hmm. of smart women who really are too busy working and looking after their families to read anything but a magazine, but who miraculously read books, good books, mm-hmm. long books, political books, and then talk about them. I go, wow, you know, that's probably basically what's keeping this country together.
Well, I think it's wonderful what she does, because she does bring books to readers out there that maybe would say, I'm not too busy, but I trust Oprah, and therefore I'm going to go down this path with her.
Yeah.
And she has created book clubs all over the country
yeah,
and the
you
world.
Know what?
And
there's no downside.
No, there isn't.
And there's, for me also personally, like, there was no downside. And maybe, you know, maybe I was a little more comfortable with the whole thing because I also have a background as a performer.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I mean, it's like, I was like, is there anything wrong with this? No, there isn't.
And it's gone to even greater lengths with now to the classics,
yeah.
which I think is
wonderful. She's got millions of people reading 100 Years of Solitude.
Yeah.
It's, you know, this is all good.
Now, are you aware of the National Endowment, the NEA study that came out in the States a couple months ago, maybe longer, I'm fuzzy on my dates, but it showed how the decline of readers. And Daniel Goya, who is, I believe, a poet laureate, he was on a talk show and talking about it, whatever. Mm-hmm. But anyway, a study has come out which has shown that readers that are in their 20s and 30s are drastically declining because of the TV and mm-hmm. on and on. The study was a little skewed, though, because they also counted people who read the Bible, but they didn't differentiate it between that and, you know, fiction.
Oh, so the numbers are even lower.
Yes, and given that, I mean, I think what Oprah does is wonderful, but it also takes me down a path of who has the responsibility, if anyone, to help, beyond Oprah, mm-hmm. to help bring books to the teenagers or the 20-year-olds
well,
or whatever.
I think it starts way before that. Parents, mm-hmm. read to your children.
Mm-hmm.
Read every night.
Yes.
The rewards are immeasurable.
Mm-hmm.
That child will never be alone. Mm-hmm. They'll never be completely bereft, no matter what happens to them in their life.
Mm-hmm.
They will always have a friend. They will always have wisdom. They'll always have a place to go.
Yes.
They'll have an inner life. They won't be trying to cram pop culture down their throats and getting hungrier and hungrier and hungrier.
Mm-hmm.
They'll always have food.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I look at it. And then when you look at the, you know, millions and millions of people who have grown up without books.
Yeah.
That's really hard. I'm not an expert. I don't know. But I do know that people love to be read to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I would probably do the same thing as I would do with a small child.
Mm-hmm.
I'd start reading to people, even a teenager or a 20-something mm-hmm. or someone who can't read.
Mm-hmm.
Being read to is very powerful.
Have you seen the movie As Good As It Gets?
Yes, I've seen it.
There's a scene in that movie where Jack Nicholson, the writer, is sitting at his computer and he's finishing his book and he's typing at the computer
mm-hmm.
and reciting out loud the end of the story. He's getting interrupted and interrupted and he can't finish it and find us. It's a great scene. Well, I'm wondering if they did a scene about you writing your book, what that would look like.
Oh, it would look like this. It would look like just like this most of the time.
Oh!
Like this, like clawing my head and my face and forcing myself to sit down and then getting up again. And, you know, it wouldn't be like that.
No. So you're a pacer then.
I'm a terrible pacer. Terrible. And, you know, as soon as I sit at my desk, I end up completely contorted. I have all the most ergonomic equipment you could possibly imagine. I had a physiotherapist come to my office and set everything up so it would be perfect for my back and my shoulder and
mm-hmm.
my wrists, you know, because I could spend 14 hours at a stretch sometimes at that
mm-hmm.
desk. And in spite of everything, I'm like this, you know, at the keyboard. So that's what it's like. It's ugly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not pretty.
It doesn't
horrible.
Sound like it.
It's horrible to be a writer. But I laughed at that movie, and I loved the fact that he was so neurotic. I think the intensity of his neurosis is absolutely
mm-hmm.
accurate.
Mm-hmm.
The manifestations of it are totally different because every writer is insane in their own way when they're working.
Mm-hmm.
But
Well, yes, you hear the stories, I mean, of whatever. I remember with Joseph Conrad, he was angst-ridden, the stories I read about him. I mean, what you describe about yourself brought him to mind, where it was painful for him to write, but he couldn't not do
it. Yeah, he can't not do it.
So are you like that at 6 to 8 hours a day, or do you just say, I'm going to do this for 4 or 5 hours? And
well, you know,
it sounds, I mean, especially being contorted, it sounds like it'd be bad on the body.
It was. It was. It's very bad. Mm-hmm. It's bad for one's health to be a writer. It's bad for my health. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness I'm not a smoker. Yeah. I'm not an alcoholic.
Faulkner sipping the scotch, huh?
Well, I have been known to sip scotch, but the only regard in which I am addictive and compulsive is with regard to the writing itself, where that's it. I'm not going to let go. It's not going to let me go until it's done, and maybe one of us is going to be killed. Mm-hmm. But this is, no one's giving up here. Mm-hmm. Writing is not easy. Writing is really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And there are moments where, again, it's like, it's a very Eeyore-like experience. Even moments of great revelation, for example, 2/3 of the way through the writing process with each of my novels, I saw, my mind leapt forward in an arc, and I saw where we were going. And it was great, because it just went clickety-clickety-clickety-click, and oh, there it is.
Oh, wow.
And the next moment is doom-laden, because it's, oh, well, yeah, you can see it. How are you ever going to articulate this? Mm. How are you ever going to distill and organize and make this feel seamless and inevitable and irresistible to the reader? Mm-hmm. That's always the next thought. So every reward is followed quickly by a dreadful sense of cost, you know. But that could just be my personality. I think it sounds pretty typical of writers, though. There aren't that many writers who don't feel this way, probably.
So why do you do it?
I have to, because the story is there, and I know that I can do it. The story, you know, if it's... I can't not finish. It's there. It needs to be born.
So how does, then, writing affect your life?
My home life?
Not, that would be, I want you to go down underneath that. Mm-hmm. Not in the daily life of how it, you know, routines and things. Perhaps how you interact with people, what you see, how it gets into, because it seems to me that life would be changed in a way, even simply by the way you observe or what you hear.
Yeah. It is very different. When I'm working on a novel, fiction in particular, this is a different type of writing than writing for theater. When I'm deep at work on the book, I feel like a scorpion in a sense. I feel, you know, how they can, or an animal that can drop its body temperature and lower all its vital signs so that it's almost dead. And in a way, I feel like I want only my imagination. I want only this strange air around my head where all the ideas are. That's the only thing that I want working and up and running. And everything else kind of shuts down so it doesn't get in the way of that. Which means that after a day of writing, I have to, for example, my office is a 45-minute walk from my home. I need that, at least that amount of time and physical exercise to decompress. But even so, if I have to pick up some milk on the way home, I feel morbidly self-conscious. I feel like I can't bear to walk into the store. I can't bear it if the person looks at me or says hello. I can't stand it, which is very strange because in the rest of my life, I'm very sociable and I'm a bit of an extrovert. But when I'm working, all that changes, and I feel like a bit of a troll, and I can't stand the light of day. I have to work in have to block out the beautiful day, and I feel like I don't have anything to say to my friends. I'm a complete dead loss at dinner because I can't talk about what I'm working on. It doesn't even make any sense to anyone else. So people say, how are you? What are you doing? Still working on it. Oh, okay. Well, we'll talk. And glad you're here and all of that. But I don't feel like I can really be at the table, although I get desperate for company. I'm not very good company.
It, it it determines who you are to
it
a certain extent.
It certainly does, which is why I'm not in a hurry to begin another book. I want to remember. I want to remember just what it does cost to take that on. Because I have a baby now, too, so I sort of think, and I think, well, you know, maybe if I write another book, it might be a totally different experience. I might go to a completely different realm. Mm-hmm. I may not be that troll, trog creature the next time. I might come up with a very different kind of book. Maybe it will be slim. Mm-hmm. A slim book.
Well, and you're coming home, and it's not as easy to be closed into your own world when you have a child.
And I just don't want to be, because I know how inhabiting it is, and I want to be inhabited by it. I don't want to miss anything. You know, she's going to be, there's those first 5 years before school really kicks in, and why would I want to miss, a single day, except for when I'm on tour and I have to.
Yeah. So are you on tour? Is this part of your tour? Okay, for the paperback coming out, right?
Yeah.
You've been to Seattle, you come here, where do you go after here?
Well, I've been across Canada, and I'm going next to New York and Kansas, and I'm going to Europe again in later in the fall. Mm-hmm. So just,
Yeah, you've got a busy schedule.
It's a fairly full dance card.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think I'm done with my questions.
Good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cassie, it was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure talking with you, too.